Much to the organizers, it's a great opportunity to come see a place where all my theorist friends, they come back from here kind of relaxed and happy. And experimentalists that come here feel more understood. So I'm going to talk to you about some work that's been done in my lab in collaboration with Jimmy Hsu's lab. Jimmy Hsu makes these things, which are kind of essential to the work. They're anodized aluminum oxide substrates that we use that have holes in them, a nice irregular array of holes. And we have found Cooper pairs in localized states in films made on these. And when I say we, that means Michael, Hung, and Shauna. And some of the data I'll show you today, Hung and Shauna got over the last week and a half. So some of it's not that polished, but I was very excited about it. So I hope I can get to it. And it's funded by the National Science Foundation. And this is our seal. So I'm going to tell you about localized Cooper pairs. I'm going to start by telling you, just reminding you what superconductor to insulator transitions are. I think I get to be the first person to talk about that this week. Excellent. Okay. Then I'll tell you about what I call an amorphous film puzzle, which is something that's bothered me for a long time. And in fact, I feel like we've made some progress on it. And I'll tell you about how we watch and look at Cooper pairs in nanohoneycomb films. And then I'll make some comparisons to amorphous film systems and then tell you some of the questions that I think kind of remain along the way. I gave a talk about this just a couple of weeks ago at a university. And Efros said to me, well, you should just call them electron pairs. And then I informed him that, in fact, Leon, that's Leon's office, and I'm in this office, and so I have to call them Cooper pairs. But I think it's reasonable to call them Cooper pairs still, all right? So let me just get, here's a superconductor to insulator transition. This is a rather famous one from Goldman's group, Haviland, Lewin, Goldman. They take a very thin superconducting, a very thin film of bismuth. And when I say very thin, I'm talking, you know, 0.4 nanometer. When it's that thin, it shows a resistance which diverges as you lower the temperature. And this is kilohms per square, right? So very much. And then you make it thicker, and it becomes kind of a weaker insulator, and I'll talk about that more later, and then it starts to superconduct. And so you get to something which will have a zero temperature resistance, at least that's what we think, and over here it's a zero temperature insulator. It's an insulator to superconductor transition. And the measurements I'm talking about are very simple measurements. They're DC. Conductance measurements. Right, so, but the question becomes, due to theories that have tried to explain behavior like this, what the localized insulating phase is. You know, what's it composed of? We know that BCS paired fermions to form bosons, and we knew that the normal state was in fact unpaired fermions. The question is, in these particular systems, where if you maybe imagine going from here to here, it's a possibility that that bosons remain over here, but they're localized. So there's this question for these systems and for others, whether or not this is bosonic or fermionic, or maybe you have some mixture. And there are theories out there. This is one, very very high profile in the last few years by Yigal and co-workers, where they see, if you will, puddling kind of. There's kind of a mixed system that can develop kind of easily in these systems. So turns out you can drive these transitions. This is indium oxide. This is one of the counterplayers to the bismuth that I showed you. If you turn on a magnetic field on a superconducting film which is made of indium oxide, you find that you can drive it into an insulating phase. But if you look at higher temperatures, you know, below what was originally the superconducting transition temperature, you find that, in fact, the system has what I arguably pretty easily are strong superconducting fluctuations, some indications that pairs are forming here, and then it's becoming an insulator. And I need to show this because I'll come back to it later, but because this is a spectacular peak. This is as good as Pons. In fact, in other indium oxide films, it gets even bigger than Pons' peak. So this is from Kapotolnik's group. Steiner and Bovinger were co-workers on this. Start with a superconductor at low magnetic field, and you start turning up the magnetic field, and at 75 millikelvin, you find that the resistance has gone from roughly zero to over 600 kilohms. So it's very, and then it goes away again. Right, so there's narrow range where you get this very spectacular insulator. Question is, what's this made of? What's this insulator made of? All right, so in order to discuss these systems, it's very useful to start thinking about the superconducting order parameter. And so I'm going to do that in two ways. One, just here it is, the two-component order parameter. It's very simple, amplitude and a phase. And if we focus on the phase part of it, we can see a way to destroy superconductivity. If you create phase fluctuations in a superconductor, you get voltages. If you have gradients in the phase, you have currents. If you put the two together, you get resistance. So if you can create a system where there are a lot of phase fluctuations, you can have a nice amplitude all over the place, but decoherence throughout, and dissipation, resistance, and maybe even insulating behavior. So one type of system, one morphology you can imagine where you can get such behavior is superconducting grains. Imagine grains that are large enough that each one is a superconductor, but you yank them apart, you pull them apart, so that each has a well-defined phase. If they're close enough together, Josephson coupling could make it so that these phases could match, but if they're far enough apart, maybe they can't. So if you have a system like that, does it superconductor or doesn't it? And you can make such things out of tin, lead, other things, if you deposit them in the correct fashion. You can get islanded films. And so what you imagine is the following. When the film is relatively thin, you have islands that are separated like this. You measure the resistance of such a system. Resistance is flat at high temperatures. And then at a temperature corresponding close to the, say, the bulk TC of tin, you see the resistance start to rise rapidly. You get an insulator. As you make it a little bit thicker, the coupling of the grains gets better. You'll see a dip, a reentrant dip, we call it, where you can imagine that the pairs are forming, but in fact, if you get to low enough temperatures, they find out that they can't maintain phase coherence, and they become an insulator. You make it thicker still, then you get something that might look like this. Now it's very strong coupling between the grains, so you get a superconductor like this. In all cases, you see structure at the bulk TC. Here it's easy to think that you have localized bosons, localized Cooper pairs on the grains, and then you have delocalized Cooper pairs here. The superconductor, an insulator superconductor transition like that. That's a trivial example of something you can get. The amorphous films are kind of more interesting, but let me just set the stage a little bit more for the discussion, just in words. So what we think about in the insulator is that you have very small Cooper pair fluctuations on the grains in the number, and then you have big phase fluctuations. And then if you go to the superconductor, you have large number fluctuations and no phase fluctuations in the system. And we know that by quantum mechanics that there's a phase number uncertainty relation. So whatever Hamiltonian you write down for the system, you would expect for these particular systems for it to produce, for it to give this kind of an uncertainty relation where the phase and the number are conjugates. So here's a good one, and it's one that people have made things, fabricated Josephson junction arrays that kind of obey this Hamiltonian. And so here we have number of Cooper pairs on the ith grain, number of Cooper pairs on the jth grain, and we're saying that these grains are coupled via some capacitance. And not only that, they can be coupled by some tunneling rate, which will be determined by the Josephson coupling energy. And so we have a charging energy here, which depends on the number of grains, number of Cooper pairs on each grain. And then a Josephson coupling, which couples the grains, which has a magnetic field dependence, and that'll be important to what we're doing later.
So the coupling is only between neighboring grains.
And it's just between neighboring ones. And this is really just for a point of start of discussion.
Do you also have sort of an on-site charging energy?
There could be. And so just, I'm not going to make a model except to have some, I need to have an EC and an EJ to point to. All right, and so if you have a large charging energy, then you'd start localizing the pairs. And if you have a large Josephson energy, you start delocalizing them, and you break the phase fluctuations. You make the phase fluctuations go to zero. And this model is good. I mean, it predicts bosonic insulators. You just have to have a big enough charging energy in the system and a small enough Josephson coupling energy. And it qualitatively works for these islanded systems. But the question that's kind of a vexing one is, does it work for all systems? And when I say for all systems, I'm thinking about amorphous film systems. Amorphous film systems imagine just a very uniform layer of a superconductor or something that wants to be a superconductor with a short mean-free path. Cooper pairs are forming all over the place, and they have that pairing interaction all over the place. In order to get to this islanded-like structure, it's something that would have to spontaneously form out of a system that just has these microscopic pairing interactions and maybe some localization effects due to the disorder in the system. It's kind of hard to imagine how you get islands, what length scale would determine the islands, but it can happen. So the question becomes, in amorphous film systems, whether or not you can treat them as islanded ones, treat them with these Josephson-like array models of the system. So before I get into that, I want to talk some more about these amorphous film systems. There's another way to destroy the superconductivity, and that's if you focus on the amplitude of the order parameter, you can see how that could happen. So here's the amplitude. Let's imagine that you reduce the amplitude of the order parameter. That is proportional to the transition temperature of the superconductor and the number of Cooper pairs in the system. And so imagine that you can make a system where you can reduce the amplitude. That's another way to destroy the order parameter. And in fact, these famous bismuth films seem to do that. So remember, we're going from low TC, this is a thin film, low TC, to high TC as we change the thickness of the film. In fact, if you were to plot TC as a function of thickness, you'd find that it went very smoothly to zero as you make the films thinner. The TC decreases there. And so you're decreasing the transition temperature at some level by reducing the areal density of Cooper pairs. You're just squishing this thing, spreading out the Cooper pairs. That seems like a pretty good way to get rid of pairs and get rid of superconductivity. What you're left with are probably, you can imagine, maybe easiest, localized fermions that are so far apart that they can't pair. But there's this problem. Indium oxide films, which are kind of famous, this is data from Hebert and Palanen. In a magnetic field, they still show this behavior. They're amorphous as far as we can tell, where it suggests that there's some pairing at higher temperatures. So we have an amorphous system showing pairs near the superconductor and insulator transition, and then other ones that aren't, that seem to be showing fermionic-like behaviors. So this looks like phase destruction. The other one looks like amplitude destruction. What's the difference? Why does one happen and the other not? And TC is a function of magnetic field. You know, the mean field transition temperature. Yeah? Drop, yes, that's roughly constant. Right. And that would be true in, you know, Danny's data. Okay, so we need to look for Cooper pairs. We need a detection method. We just use the idea that the way you find Cooper pairs originally was by using multiply connected geometries. And so we have these great substrates. We're going to put films on them, make films with a lot of holes in them. We'll look at the superconductor and insulator transitions of films on these holy substrates. We'll apply magnetic fields. You'll see, and then we're going to compare our data to our unpatterned films. Sorry, I did that because I can. So here are nano honeycomb films. This is how we make them. This is a close-up of one of those substrates. There's a unit cell that's important to what I'm talking about. There's 100 nanometers. That's the coherence length, the zero temperature, is our best estimate of it. So we simply deposit bismuth, this amorphous bismuth, just like the Goldman group, onto these substrates. And we wind up, the stuff that goes into the holes, nobody cares about, including the other electrons in the film. All right, so how are we going to detect the Cooper pairs? Well, we simply use the fact that the canonical momentum depends on the vector potential. That means that the Cooper pair phase is going to obey this relationship. Those are supercurrents of the vector potential. That's the penetration depth. And so you should get flux periodic properties in systems that have Cooper pairs, provided the Cooper pairs are coherent at least around the circles. And so we'll see flux periodic properties in resistance. You'd imagine that they could also show up in thermodynamic quantities as well, or in tunneling. But we're just interested in the resistance. Things that I'm going to be using through the talk are this matching field. So this will be the field period that we expect for Cooper pairs in the system, and we'll be using the frustration. So here are the superconductor and insulator transitions for unpatterned amorphous bismuth films. This is just like the Goldman data collapse. It's data we took. So again, you see resistance to superconductor as you change the thickness. And what happens when you put holes in the system. So here's the nano honeycomb substrate, and there are qualitative differences that I want to bring out here. One of the big ones is that, in fact, right before you see superconductivity here, there's reentrance. This is a superconductor. That's an insulator, right? You see this reentrance, suggesting that there are Cooper pairs that are starting to form. There's no such reentrance over here. The other thing to notice is that these resistances are rising much more rapidly in temperature than the ones close to the transition here, suggesting this is a much more strongly localized system. And then the superconducting transition, when it first occurs at least, is very broad. But it's there. Okay, so the unpatterned films, that's these ones. If we look at the temperature dependence of the resistance, just on the insulating side of the transition, well, the way you do that for systems where you expect fermions is you take the resistance, you flip it over, and you measure the conductance. And we find that the change in the conductance for the insulating side goes roughly logarithmically with the temperature, which is the signature of fermions that are trying to localize, because it's in the weakly localized regime. So in fact, this is one thing that convinces us that those unpatterned films, in fact, have fermions in their insulating phase, and no bosons, no Cooper pairs. All right, so now let's go back to the pattern films. Again, here's another SIT for the pattern films. Again, here's that reentrance. If we look at the resistance as a function of 1 over temperature instead, we find that far from the transition, we see very strongly activated behavior. As we get closer to the transition, that activation energy, this exponential rise in the resistance, the speed of that drops as you get closer to the transition. The activation energy seems to drop. And, you know, we're fitting this to an activated form. If we only had these, we wouldn't be able to really do that in good faith and call it an energy. But anyway, we see a gradual evolution in the slope of the resistance as a function of 1 over the temperature. So there's a well-defined energy which seems to be going to zero as we go toward the insulator superconductor transition. And we're seeing this exponential behavior. If you put on a magnetic field, something remarkable happens. Here's one close to the transition. This is in zero magnetic field. Its resistance is maybe rising exponentially. This is F equal to zero. You put on half a flux quantum per unit cell. And you find that the resistance goes up, well, if you're at low temperatures, it goes up an order of magnitude. The activation energy changes with magnetic field. You go to one flux quantum per unit cell, it goes down again. So we're starting to see periodic behavior in the resistance as a function of field. Then that's for Cooper pairs. So here, if you sit at a fixed temperature and measure the resistance as a function of the frustration, you see oscillations. And again, they correspond to the superconducting flux quantum. So we have insulators that are showing oscillations with the superconducting flux quantum, suggesting that there are Cooper pairs in the insulating phase of these systems. We put holes into these films, and all of a sudden we get localized Cooper pairs in the insulator. So that's one of the big stories. That's one of the big messages today. By changing the geometry of the system, in fact, we've changed the quality of the transition and also been able to see that we have localized Cooper pairs in the insulator. Another interesting fact is that the way we're seeing the Cooper pairs, we're watching the resistance oscillate, and it's oscillating in a very interesting way. It's an oscillation in the activation energy that's occurring. So somehow or another, the microscopic state of the system is changing with the magnetic field. Now, I'm not sure, there's a barrier maybe that's changing periodically that it has to get over. But it's not as though we're changing a prefactor. Right? You could imagine that the R0 in the exponential dependence was moving up and down, which would maybe suggest a percolation-like model where... And it's all the time insulating. Well, until we make it a little thicker. Yeah. Yes, please. So you mean... we haven't tried it yet. that's one of the things we'd like to try, but we haven't had a chance to try that yet. We think it'll be a much smaller signal, but we'd like to. Sorry about this. Go. All right. So here are the energy scales. This is the act. These black points are the activation energy in zero magnetic field. So it starts at 4 Kelvin and it goes gradually to zero. And this is where we think the superconductor and insulator transition occurs. The red ones are the activation energies at F equal to 1/2. And so they're here. You don't see oscillations below this film thickness or for activation energies in the zero state, in the zero field state above this value. Interestingly, where you start to see the oscillations is when the transition temperature of the unpatterned film, the energy scale associated with that, TC naught, is greater than the activation energy in the transport. Okay. So questions that I'm not asking you, but I will later. Please. So. No, they continue, and I'll say that in a second. In fact, it's kind of eerie how they continue. They just keep going. Yeah. But you don't see them in the very thin films, right? We at the level of a percent, we don't. Okay. So we don't really know what this transport process is in the insulator. It's kind of an odd one. Are these Cooper pairs hopping around? Are they tunneling? I'll give a couple of ideas, but in fact, they don't work that great yet. We don't know what's localizing these Cooper pairs. Again, we put these holes in here, and all of a sudden we have Cooper pairs that are localizing instead of giving us a superconductor. And we don't know how localized they are. How big are these wave functions? We do know at this stage that the localization length is bigger than the unit cell size. All right, so there are a couple of possibilities. One is that you could have nearest neighbor hopping. And for those of you who have done mesoscopic physics, this can maybe be recognizable as this is the energy level spacing, say, in a small grain, a grain which has a volume of pi c squared times some thickness. And that energy level spacing needs to be on the order of a Kelvin, but that means a localization length of about 10 nanometers, which means that they have to be kind of localized to regions like this, regions smaller than what it would take to get a Cooper pair all the way around the hole. So it can't be something. 10 minutes left? Excellent. So then next thing is, maybe it's Josephson junction array physics that it's applying. And so what I'm thinking about here is some kind of a Coulomb charging energy, which is tending to localize the Cooper pairs. So imagine that you model this array as a bunch of islands, the green, coupled by Josephson junctions. And then you say, okay, well, let's estimate what the charging energy would be for, say, for one of these islands, And so there's only one length scale, really. It's about 50 nanometers that would enter a capacitance measurement. So you calculate the charging energy, and you get 10,000 Kelvin per epsilon. It doesn't seem too relevant to these dilution refrigerator experiments. There is a dielectric constant. We're near a metal insulator transition. Maybe it's diverging. We don't know. But there's another way you could maybe think about this. Maybe this, if you continue to think the charging energies matter, you could turn this on its head. Say epsilon is equal to 1. What would L have to be for you to get a reasonable charging energy? That would be a localization length. And so you need something about this size or bigger. You need Cooper pairs in wave functions that are over, localized over thousands of holes. And maybe that's what it is. So we only have a tentative picture at this stage, that we have Cooper pair wave functions that are localized over lots and lots of holes. And tentatively, what happens is you turn on the magnetic field, you change the activation energy by changing the local Josephson coupling energies. Maybe that causes the wave function to shrink or undulate. Maybe it changes how easy it is to hop over barriers. We're not sure. And then you get this very large resistance, this strong resistance. You have a Coulomb barrier, charge 2E. That means 4 times greater energy to get over the barrier than for single electron. Yes. Right. All right, so here's this superconducting part. So this is another series of films. What we've done is these are different film thicknesses, each red, blue, and green. They're triplets that go together. So this is the thinnest film. That's the thickest film down here. We've normalized the resistances. And what I'm showing you is the resistance of the function of 1 over temperature at zero field, half a matching field, and one matching field. And as you make it, when it's thinnest, you see small oscillations. When it's thickest, you see big oscillations. And even when it's superconducting, you see the oscillations. So it kind of just moves very smoothly from insulator to superconductor through the system. What that means for the superconductor is that you can get multiple field-tuned superconductor and insulator transitions. So this data came from this week. So this is a R, that's resistance, that's magnetic field in Tesla. And these are at different temperatures for a single film. And if you look carefully, you can see crossing points here, which maybe would correspond to the critical field for some field-tuned superconductor to insulator transitions. What those transitions look like is kind of interesting. So here's resistance versus 1 over T, if you've gotten used to that at this stage. So the superconductor looks like this in zero field. Then you turn on the magnetic field, you get this tail, which grows and goes up. There's definitely reentrance in the system. And I'll go back to the indium oxide in a second. There's reentrance in the system, and you can see that very clearly here. So this is at half a matching field, and then it will go back down again as you turn the field up higher. It's nearly metallic over a large range of fields. We don't quite understand why that is. But what's interesting is that these data look rather similar, I would argue, to these data. That we're seeing a field-tuned transition that looks very much like what's happening in indium oxide. The way we're seeing is we've made the geometry multiply connected. Maybe there's some underlying disorder, multiply connected geometry in the system. And I will come back. Oh, yeah. The other thing that's interesting is that if you look at these indium oxide films on the insulating side, so if you were to look at this R versus T, I'm mixing data from different groups, you would find that there's an activation energy which is describing the transport. That is, these become exponentially rising resistances. They're also activated. So they see activated behavior on the insulating side of their transitions as well. So just like the nano honeycomb films. So for me, this is closing a loop a little bit. We have amorphous films, we put holes in them, and we're starting to get behavior that people are seeing another amorphous film system. They also see these spectacular peaks. I mean, so the most spectacular one is the one from Shahar's group, from Wiseman. And their peak goes to they can't measure it. It gets to a gigohm or more. It just becomes enormous. And again, in all cases, you start from a low resistance, go through this enormous resistance, then go back to, well, not as lower resistance. This past week, my students have been going to higher fields, and they finally got good data to show this. And so this is a superconducting film. The resistance of it is a function of magnetic field on an ordered array. And what you can see at low magnetic fields, it starts at zero resistance, you see the oscillations. And then as you increase the field higher, you get this ginormous peak. And one of the things that we're excited about is, well, a couple of things, is qualitatively this looks very much like the peak that people were getting in the other amorphous systems. The other thing is, and I know I put these lines in and slightly biased things, but if you look at it right here, you can believe that, in fact, those bumps are running up the side of the peak, which implies that you have localized Cooper pairs at least on this side of the peak. You couldn't tell that from the indium oxide data or titanium nitride. What happens out here? Okay, so this is low field, this is high field. We go up and we go down. This has been a puzzling area. There are some exotic things that have been seen in titanium nitride that suggest that there's kind of a special metal phase out here. This week, they got data in the lab that suggests something else. And so I'm going to look out here. These are different temperatures. And so we're just going to take a cut like this and actually measure the conductance. And it appears that as, and again, so this is really raw. This is 5 Tesla, 6 Tesla, 7 Tesla. So the blue one is the highest field one, the blue one in all these. These are different films. What you see is if you plot conductance normalized by G00. G00, if I remember correctly, is E squared over 2 pi squared H bar. It's 3 minutes. Perfect. 81 kiloohms. It's a quantum of resistance that appears in the weak localization theories. In those weak localization theories, if you normalize things by G00, the slope should be roughly 1 for this logarithmic plot. And so 1 is 2 units here. So it's very close to 1. It's like 0.8. So we think we're actually recovering the fermions when we go to really, really high fields in these systems, which is good, you know. Well, some of us, there are fermions in the world, bosons in the world, not very fermion favorable. Okay, so here's a summary of our latest data, and I'm kind of finding the most exciting right now. We have bosons down here at low fields. We have fermions up here. What's going on in here? We hope we can learn more in the future with some more experiments. You got my ear, and co-workers have ideas about this. Galitsky and co-workers have ideas about this, and we'll see where they come. Maybe there are kind of mixtures of these two in the middle, probably. So we've seen strongly localized Cooper pairs, you know, rather clearly, I think. We see Cooper pair transport near the superconductor insulator transition. The insulator superconductor transition is kind of interesting and different because there's a vanishing energy scale, which we can seem to identify for this transition, which is different from the ones that people have been thinking about. And again, there's this patterning that somehow or another is enhancing the Cooper pair localization, and we don't have a good handle on how that's happening, but it is happening. And that's it. Thank you very much for your attention.
The Pauli limiting field?
There's very strong spin orbit scattering in these, and so it's enormous. It's well past 8 Tesla. It's the spin orbit scattering is mixing the spins like crazy. So
the other thing is, with this kind of field, are you expecting weak localization physics to be relevant in such a high magnetic field?
Well, when I say that, I'm also lumping in disordered enhanced electron-electron interaction effects, and so I might think that they'd be more relevant, but they also give the log T dependence. And
there is some data, some work by Danny Schachel's group on strips of indium oxide which show oscillations very similar to what you've shown, but in the superconducting side. So
I think strips? Oh, I haven't seen those.
Yeah, well, it's published 2 years ago. We can talk about it later. But I think it might be related.
Okay.
There's sort of a dual to this that people have looked at over many years, like, I forget the names, Moschalkov, I think, is one of the big names in this field with patterned, sort of putting patterned holes on thin films and looking for actually the localization of the vortices in a magnetic field and looking for matching fields that way.
Uh-huh.
And mostly they look at things like depinning fields for the vortices when they're, so sort of nonlinear transport is what they're mostly interested in. I'm wondering if, you know, if you go into the very strong superconducting side of this, if that would continuously connect to the oscillations that you see. Have you looked at?
So we've definitely looked at thicker films, and we've seen, if you will, little parps-like oscillations in the transition temperature. So it does kind of adiabatically move to something like that. We haven't, say, gone to low temperatures and tried to depin the vortices from those states, but it's something we could do, and it might be very interesting.
Hi,
I'd just like to mention that according to our theory, if you think about the insulator as a random resistor network, then the maximum in the magnetoresistance is determined by the point where you cross from a critical resistor, which is superconductor, Cooper pair transport, to a critical resistor, which is an electron. So if you were able to carry your oscillations through the peak, the prediction is that the period should change at the peak from 2E to 1E.
Yes, that'll be fun to look for.
Why would what stop? No, I mean, the problem with oscillation, according to Jim, is the fact that because you have many holes of different areas, as you go to higher field, you average over more periods. So that's a technical point in the experiment.
Yeah, let me show you. So we've been able to compare disordered and ordered substrates. And this is a whole correlation function. Right, so that's how we maybe can characterize it, is the order in the whole. So you see lots of oscillations for what we call the ordered one and very few for the disordered. Yes, that's right. Sorry. Well, yeah. That's right. Sure. In some regimes, it grows exponentially.
Yeah, but it always grows at
people. Because you have two activated behaviors.
Well, no, you just take the oscillating part, the amplitude of the oscillating part.
Right.
What is that temperature difference? It's also activated.
For the first oscillation, it's going to be activated because you're subtracting two activated functions.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? So at F equals 1/2, it's activated. At F equals 0, it's activated. The activation energies are different. And the oscillation amplitude is the difference between the F equals 0 and F equals 1/2 resistances.
Okay, that's not what I'm looking for. Okay,
I'm sorry. But yeah, so the thing is that the number of oscillations goes down as the order goes down. So it's not the phase coherence of the Cooper pairs that determine the number of oscillations that we see, as far as for the order that we have so far.
Mm-hmm.